It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. People who have legal issues will often turn to a law library for information, especially if they can't afford an attorney. Sometimes the situation is complicated by mental health challenges, their own or those of family members. Linda Tashbook is an adjunct professor of law and librarian at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. She's also author of a new book, Family Guide to Mental Illness and the Law. Linda Tashbook, welcome to The Confluence.
Hi, Kevin.
So libraries are apparently in your blood. You've been a law librarian at Pitt for more than 20 years now?
Yeah, 21 years.
Okay. Before that, you were a children's librarian. How did that transition come about?
Oh, well, that transition came about because as a children's librarian, my particular interest was in outreach and reversing the cycle of illiteracy. And so I did a lot of work with public housing communities. I did outreach to shelters. In fact, set up reading rooms in, this was a very long time ago, you
right.
know, but in the late 80s and early 90s, set up reading rooms in the what then were 14 shelters serving families in western Pennsylvania. And I participated in the Allegheny County Homeless Youth Network. And so I was going to all these meetings with shelter directors and case managers and police. And everybody was doing such exciting, important things. And I thought, I want to do more. And so I went to law school to learn how to be a real advocate.
So why does someone who's not a law student come in off the street to the Pitt Law Library?
Well, as you were saying, you know, a lot of people suffer injustices in their lives, or they know somebody who's suffering an injustice. And they think, well, the library's supposed to have information. Let me see if I can find out what I need to know about what the legal issue is or what legal action I can take.
Mm-hmm. So are they usually looking to do research themselves, read materials that might pertain to their situation, or do they come right to you or colleague and seek advice? And number two, if it is the latter, can you actually offer advice?
I'm sure that sometimes when people come in, they're hoping that we will just give them the legal answer. In the law library, we have to be very careful about that. We cannot give legal advice. Some of the law librarians are practicing attorneys, as I am. But when I'm at the law library, I'm a librarian, and I cannot give legal advice in that setting. And so I show people how to find information, and that information can be in all kinds of sources. It's not always the case that there are only big, heavy law books to read.
Mm-hmm.
But and I hope this isn't too much of a tangent. Just in August, for example, thinking of mental illness and the law and people doing research, in August, the trade journal for the publishing industry, which is titled Publishers Weekly, ran a feature about books on suicide. And they ran this feature because there are such high book sales on suicide books. And so there's a big market for this, and it was worthy of an article. Now, what they show in their article is that a lot of people want to read suicide books for affirmation. They read a lot of people tend to buy memoirs about suicide. My book also covers suicide, but because my book is a law book, it addresses issues like liability for cleaning up if there has been property damage during the commission of a suicide, or it covers insurance law, life insurance law associated with suicide. It covers sometimes families are looking to sue somebody else in connection with the suicide. Maybe you remember hearing about some medications that would cause severe depression.
Right.
And so, that's the kind of content that's in my book.
Okay. So you mentioned the suicide, but over the years, what are some other legal issues that library users are confronting that might be directly linked to their mental health issues? So legal issues that might be linked to their mental health issues. Give us an example or two.
Something that we see a lot of has to do with housing, actually. In the past year, I've had at least three library users, all of whom showed very obvious what I would say would be symptoms of mental illness, and all of whom were losing their housing for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. One, actually, we did not know this person was going to be losing housing. This was somebody who was researching, he was researching assorted things in the law library, and one day when he was there, he said that he was actually supposed to be in court at that time for an eviction hearing. He was being evicted because of a hoarding tendency. And I certainly never knew that he had a hoarding tendency. And I didn't even know that he was on the verge of being evicted. If he had mentioned that at some point coming into the law library, you know, we could have shown him articles about, you know, that show step by step how to fight an eviction. We could have shown him some of the documents that you would file, and even the agencies that can help you organize your stuff if you are someone with a hoarding tendency.
But again, show the materials, not advise or explain. Or is that a blurry issue?
Mm-hmm. So that would seem more like giving legal advice, and we would be very careful to just show the materials and in a dialogue with the library patron, talk about, does this look like information that would be useful to you? And to get a sense of how much work they feel able to do and that they want to do, and then we know how to dig deeper for information that can help as they proceed.
All right, so you talked about people faced with losing their homes. What about, do you work with people who have already lost their homes, the homeless, and what sort of issues are they confronting?
There is such a large variety of issues that people have when they're homeless. And yes, people who are homeless do come into the law library, and I'm very happy for that. I like that people can come indoors and that they feel comfortable and confident with us in the law library. I'm thinking of one person, really felt like a dear friend because he came to the law library for years. And I remember a situation, this is a kind of injustice that would happen to somebody, and it happened to him mm-hmm. because he was someone who lived outside.
Right.
And he was sleeping one night, and somebody came along and shined a flashlight in his face. It woke him up. He lashed out with his arm, hitting the person, and that person called the police and claimed that this man who was homeless had assaulted him. In fact, the man who shined the flashlight was someone who had basically been stalking this person who used our library all the time, and it was a setup, really. So the police come, and they have before them this clean-cut person who's asserting he was just out for a morning jog.
Who do you believe, right?
Right. You know, do you believe the person who's homeless and scruffy and maybe not making a lot of sense? And because this was someone who, this person who was homeless, had a lot of things that he was afraid of, and he believed some things that other people didn't necessarily believe. And so he ended up being the one charged with a crime. But he was a frequent library user, and so he came to the library, and this was the great reference question that he asked. His question was, because, you know, the police recorded everything, the time of the 911 call was recorded at the time the police came. This man came into the library, and he said, "Can you help me prove what time the sun came up that day?" Because the person, you know, when everything shook out, nobody knew whether it was daylight or dark anymore. But he knew that it was dark, and this person shined a flashlight in his face. And that was a significant part of his case. And we were able to check with National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, which, of course, will be tracking Santa Claus in a few weeks, and confirm for him that it was still dark out.
Did he win?
Yes, he did prevail in that situation.
All right, we have just a few minutes left. So, very briefly, you sort of alluded to, how well do you get to know some of these individuals?
Oh, we know people who come, when people come in frequently to the law library, sure. Well, you know what, I should say, I don't usually know people's last names. you know, we'll get to know on a first name basis.
And their faces, obviously.
Sure. And whatever they happen to tell us, we tend not to dig around for a lot of personal information, not wanting to make anybody feel scrutinized in the library.
So whether it's homelessness, mental health, or a combination of need, how can the library become a force for change in their lives, do you feel?
First of all, by acknowledging people's humanity and dignity. This is somebody of intelligence who has gone to the trouble of finding their way to the library and looking for information. And we honor that. And a force for change in terms of equipping them with information that they can take and use to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. And stand up for their rights.
Right. Stand up for their rights and understand that they do have rights.
Absolutely.
So you've written your book for family members or people with mental health issues. How do you hope it helps the individual, but also the family member who wants to help that individual?
I hope that it will give all readers the knowledge and courage to do something instead of feeling, oh, this is the law. I'm up against the law, and the law is all of society. It's a very daunting position to be in. But this book, it's written in plain English. It's got lots of helpful features to break up the information, to make it clear to look at. And it explains things so that people will feel strong enough to take some action. And the book tells what kinds of actions are available and what kinds of resources are available.
Do you feel like you and the law library, in a sense, maybe our last resort for people with mental health challenges, but also trying to understand their legal rights, what actions they can do?
That is very well put. That is exactly what we think. We try hard to be that resource.
So, and how can you explain? How can you further explain? Yeah, you might perceive it as just little old me versus the law versus the big establishment, that the odds might be big, but still you can win.
You know, once you start to read what the elements of the law are and you get a feel for the procedure, we will often show people like the handbooks, guidelines, manuals that exist for, say, the hearing officers that they would be interacting with. We give them the context for the situation that they are going into and the rules that they're up against so that they know how this thing is played and they're not in an inferior position.
Mm-hmm. So maybe the last resort for some, but do you ever have to sort of draw the line? You see people regularly, as you mentioned, visit the library. You obviously know their faces. You know the materials that might be helpful for them, but they aren't necessarily your clients. So do you have to draw the line?
Well, that's an easy distinction to make, to be able to say, I can provide you with legal information in the library, but not legal advice.
All right. Linda Tashbook is an adjunct professor of law. She's a law librarian at the University of Pittsburgh Law School and is the author of Family Guide to Mental Illness and the Law. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up, regions still reeling from the industrial downturn have high hopes for the petrochemical industry. It's The Confluence.
I'm Mick Stinelli with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the city of Pittsburgh annexes the neighborhood of Homewood in 1884. The community was founded by politician and judge William Wilkins and soon became home to many of the city's wealthy industrialists, including Andrew Carnegie. Homewood North, South, and West are now populated by about 800 residents. It includes a branch of the Carnegie Library, the historic Homewood Cemetery, and the Afro-American Music Institute. Photographer Charles Teeny Harris and the musician and entrepreneur Mary Cardwell Dawson are among the neighborhood's notable previous residents. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Homewood fiber artist Tina Brewer recently received the Governor's Award for Artist of the Year. Brewer spoke with 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort about the quilting technique that she has shared for decades with seniors, students, and other artists.
Tina Brewer, you are celebrated for your story quilts. Whose stories are you telling?
I'm telling the stories of our ancestors, and I come from a family where I sat at the kitchen table and ate food and listened to the stories, and that's how they communicated our history to us about the family. So as I started to pick up my pieces and started to quote, I thought it would be important to use that as an impetus to tell the stories so that people won't be forgotten. And I've been working pretty much since 1985 on the Middle Passage, and I have tried to capture the history from the Middle Passage going backwards instead of forwards to say what we brought to this country rather than what they say about us in this country.
What did it mean to you to receive the Governor's Award, being named Artist of the Year for 2018?
I was overwhelmed by it because, of course, everyone works hard. My work, I think, is good. It speaks to the importance to my community and my people, but to have it be acknowledged by the greater community is important. It really took me back, and so I'm forever grateful. I've been working with the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts for about 20 years. I worked with the Society for Contemporary Crafts for 23 years. And for that time, I've done community work. So I've been working as a community artist for about 23 years. And so you just do that work and love that work. And then to have somebody pick it up and say, you know, this is worthy of a celebration, makes my heart.
Who influenced you the most?
When I first started out, my father-in-law really influenced me in terms of capturing that ancient history, and then the ancient African history classes that were at the Homewood Library was inspirational as well. But the technique that I used is one that I made up. So I still do a lot of scrapping because it's important to use fabric that comes with its own energy. So I love to use, like I made some quilts from my father-in-law's ties, from old scraps of fabric from my family members. So I kind of repurposed, so we've been repurposing for a long time.
It's also important to you that you share and you work with others and you teach.
And I think that comes from my upbringing. The more you give, the more you receive. You know, I am a teacher who teaches everything that I know, and I give it over to you, and something new comes. And so I'm not afraid to let it all be practiced by other artists, and then I enjoy their success. Mm-hmm. So I've been teaching what my exploration is, my process is, from the very beginning.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The petrochemical industry is promising economic development in many Rust Belt towns where it's sorely needed. But many are wary of the pollution that this new chemical boom could bring. In part one of their series about communities bearing the brunt of pollution, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant takes a look at East Liverpool, Ohio, a town that's welcoming this new industry while still dealing with pollution from facilities that have been there for decades.
East Liverpool could be considered beautiful, sitting along the Ohio River with a view of the foothills. It's just north of the West Virginia Panhandle at the Ohio-Pennsylvania border. But it's faced years of hard times. You might remember a devastating photo in 2016, two people passed out in a car from a heroin overdose with a four-year-old looking on from the back seat. That was East Liverpool.
East Liverpool has been ravaged by the drug issues, and there is no work.
Amanda Kiger is a community activist with children and grandchildren in East Liverpool. Unemployment rates in the city are higher than the state as a whole. The percentage of people in poverty and living with disabilities is also higher.
Our city is so poor that our school system, everybody gets free lunch. You do not even have to do an application in East Liverpool schools anymore.
East Liverpool was once considered the pottery capital of the nation. Kiger drives me past the Hull China factory, where she sold lunches as a teenager.
You see that there's very little people that actually work there now.
I couldn't tell if it was open or not.
It's barely. barely open.
The coal industry that flourished here for a while is also on its way out. In recent decades, the city is probably best known for its hazardous waste incinerator, one of the world's largest, formerly called WTI and now known as Heritage Thermal Services.
This is actually Heritage right here. This is WTI. And you see, like, it's literally housed in the neighborhood here.
We're just a few hundred feet from homes in a low-income neighborhood. There's a low smokestack and a loading area for waste. Everything from medical waste to nail polish to waste from government Superfund sites is burned inside. Many people remember July 13th, 2013, the day the incinerator released nearly 800 pounds of potentially hazardous ash into the air. It included arsenic and manganese.
And it covered the whole East End area with ash.
As part of her job, Kiger gathers stories of people experiencing environmental problems here.
We had a girl, and she's now moved away. She said, you know, they getting in the car, we're going to leave for, I believe it was a doctor's appointment. She said, we hear a boom, and all of a sudden my son, my mother, my car, my house, just covered in ash.
So we're going to take a moment, and we're going to collect the index cards.
It's been about 5 years since that incident, and in mid-November, the U.S. Department of Justice and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency held a joint meeting at the East Liverpool City Hall about a consent decree they'd reached with Heritage. In the proposal, Heritage Thermal President Chris Fearson says they've agreed to pay a $600,000 penalty. Just under half of that would go to the federal government.
And we are excited to be able to spend the majority of the money for the penalty, over $300,000 here locally in the community of East Liverpool for lead abatement projects.
Fearson says the money will be used to fix lead water lines and lead paint in homes within 25 miles of the plant. And he says the incinerator is no longer accepting the kind of waste that caused the incident. But city resident Thomas Redmond's not convinced. He told regulators he's worried about his three kids.
Since WTI or Heritage, whoever, however you want to call them, moved in East End, I mean, there has been a lot more issues with cancer and stuff like that.
EPA attorney John Mattson says the government has no proof of that.
EPA does not have any evidence of any health effects that the people are suffering. If anybody has anything like that, you can submit it to us at any point in time, but I am not aware of anything.
EPA engineer Linda Rosen encouraged people at the hearing to call in complaints.
I think I've only received one complaint from the facility.
Well, that's because nobody has jobs here.
Mitzi Stoddard, a resident here, thinks people are scared to complain because of the 180 jobs at the incinerator.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of these people won't say nothing because that's the only way they're feeding their family.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, we might die in 20 years, but I'm going to feed my kid today.
Sure.
Even though the Heritage Incinerator has signed multiple consent decrees with the government after pollution violations through the years, Tom Redmond, like many others here, thinks city leaders and regulators are failing them.
I mean, I understand East Liverpool. I understand we're kind of in a rut, and we kind of need all the help possible for jobs and stuff like that. But, I mean, don't you guys think as, you guys are supposed to be protecting us?
And as we'll hear later, for many families, government action has come too late, and the damage from air pollution has already been done. For The Confluence, I'm Julie Grant.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Carol Holsoppel of the Allegheny Front, along with my colleague Julie Grant. We're talking about East Liverpool, an industrial town along the Ohio River, just over the border from Pennsylvania. It's part one of our series looking at how pollution in our region is impacting people's health and what's being done about it. So, Julie, it sounds like there's a long history of pollution in East Liverpool.
Yeah, opposition to the incinerator started even before it was built. As incoming vice president in 1992, Al Gore kind of famously promised to prevent the incinerator from opening, saying it was, quote, unbelievable that a plant that burns hazardous waste would be located in a floodplain like this. And then a few months after Clinton and Gore were sworn in, the incinerator was permitted to open.
Do we know if there have been documented health impacts from the incinerator?
Well, in the early 1990s, the Ohio Department of Health found a significantly higher rate of cancer deaths in East Liverpool than the rest of the surrounding county, the state, or even the country. But that was so soon after the incinerator had opened, the state attributed the high rate to high smoking rates rather than pollution from the plant. That was about 25 years ago, and there hasn't been a study focused on cancer rates specifically in East Liverpool since then. And as I mentioned before, the US EPA says it has no evidence of health effects from the incinerator.
Still, East Liverpool has had high pollution levels that at least one researcher connected to health impacts in the community.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, tell me more about that.
Well, in 2010, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, that's a federal agency, found that the levels of the heavy metal manganese in the air in East Liverpool were a public health hazard. This finding was based on monitoring by the Ohio EPA at three different sites in East Liverpool from the year 2000 to 2009. The monitor at the East End Elementary School found elevated levels of airborne manganese, and another of the air monitors, one right near a metal processing facility, found levels more than 34 times what would cause health problems. The Ohio EPA said in their report it couldn't find a higher amount of airborne manganese in the country.
And that facility is owned by Pittsburgh-based SH Bell, and it stores metals like manganese to be processed into things like batteries and stainless steel by other companies.
That's right.
One source of manganese has been dust coming from SH Bell's facility.
Yeah, when I was driving around East Liverpool with activist Amanda Kiger, she stopped in the neighborhood that's only a few hundred feet from SH Bell, and you could see on the sides of the houses that face the facility, there's a brown staining. Kiger says that's manganese.
And you'll see, like, across that roof back there, you'll see rust colored up there. You'll see across the front of here.
So our bodies need manganese for bone health, for metabolizing fat and carbohydrates. It's in healthy foods like leafy greens and nuts. We can excrete what we don't need, but it's different when you breathe it in. Last year, I spoke with Erin Haynes, an environmental epidemiologist at the University of Cincinnati. And she says when people breathe in airborne manganese, it can be toxic.
Through the nose, through the lungs, through the respiratory system, manganese particles can travel directly through the olfactory nerve and enter directly into the brain.
Too much manganese can be a neurotoxin like lead. Manganese has been known to cause tremors and loss of coordination and balance in people, and to affect memory and the brain's ability to function.
Right. So a couple of years after the state found such high manganese levels in East Liverpool, the city school district started noticing something. High rates of students qualifying for special education services. 19% in East Liverpool compared with 13% statewide.
And that's why Erin Haynes and her team started testing kids in the area to see if there was a connection with the airborne manganese. They tested 100 kids ages 7 through 9 for levels of manganese in their bodies and for their IQ score, and they found a connection.
We did see an association between the level of manganese in the child's body and then lower IQ scores. So the higher the concentration within the child, the lower the IQ.
So, Julie, what was it like for families going through this testing?
Well, I did talk with some of them. I met with Eileen Herduck and her daughter Jessica, who at the time was getting ready to start high school at Connie's Corner. It's a diner in Chester, just a few miles from East Liverpool.
She just got, what'd you get?
A pancake with strawberries and hash browns.
Both parents work full-time, and they run a small farm, cows, pigs, and chickens.
She lives on a farm, and she hates eggs.
When Eileen Herduck heard about the manganese study, she wanted her daughter tested.
There's a lot of people my age in their 40s and 50s in the area that are dying from cancer. So whenever I first heard that, it was important to me just to get her into it so I could see what everything was doing in the area. Because, I mean, we're out by the power plants in Pennsylvania there in Shippingport, but we're here all the time too, so just the whole area here, it was important for me to see what it would affect her.
About 3 or 4 years ago, Jessica went through a round of testing to see how much manganese is in her body and to determine her IQ. They cut pieces of her hair, took blood samples, clipped her toenails, and they wanted her saliva.
You had to like spit in this little jar and fill it up just so far. It was really weird. It took a long time.
get enough saliva.
Yeah.
Then there was the IQ portion.
You had to do this math question thing. It was time. You had to see how many problems you could done in 15 minutes. And then they did like a spelling test thing. And then a whole bunch of questions of like my normal foods and stuff that I ate.
Jessica didn't think the test was too bad. Plus, she got to spend the $50 the researchers paid participants. Her family waited a few months, and then an envelope came with the results.
Some of the things were up higher than normal.
Eileen Herduck says while the elevated level of manganese in her daughter's body was worrisome, they haven't seen evidence of any learning disability.
But I know it didn't affect her. She's in the honor society and she's getting A's. And her plans are to go on to be a vet. So that's going to be 8+ years of schooling.
The researchers did another round of testing with the same kids this past summer, now that they're teenagers. Jessica took part in that one, too. The results have not been publicly released.
So this family lives in a community outside of East Liverpool. What about some of the children who live closer to these industrial facilities?
One parent I spoke with, Tracy Lamb, is raising her children in the neighborhood that's kind of sandwiched between S.H. Bell and the Heritage Thermal Waste Incinerator. She's disabled and on Social Security. She's a homemaker and her husband is unemployed. Lamb grew up around East Liverpool. She says some of her kids were part of the manganese study, and when she first opened the results...
I just remember reading it, great anticipation and worry, and when I saw their results and a lot of the levels that had been raised and stuff, even higher than kids that live next to a manganese-producing plant in Mexico, they're testing higher than these kids. It was frightening. I mean, it was terrifying. And then you think in your head, okay, what do I do? Because if you go to a pediatrician with these results, they're not, they don't know what to do. I mean, there's no like medical precedence for testing kids for manganese and these other things. And so it's like, what do you even do? I mean, I was interested in it for a while. I looked it up. I Googled it, the effects, causes. You're just up against a wall as to what you can even do other than move. I'm not sure I think about it all the time. It's why I'd love to move, but just right now, it's just not a possibility for us. You worry and you wonder why, and then you feel powerless.
That was Tracy Lamb of East Liverpool, and she's not alone. There's been disappointment by others since the first round of testing results were made public.
We had showed that, you know, we have, for one, we had the highest manganese levels ever recorded in the United States. And then we proved that the high manganese levels in the children in that area was causing development hardships, was literally making them lose IQ points.
That's community activist Amanda Kiger again. She says local, state, and federal officials all saw the study results. In early 2018, the U.S. EPA did take action to get S.H. Bell to reduce the amount of manganese in the air. The agency and S.H. Bell signed a consent decree. In an email to the Allegheny Front, the company denied wrongdoing and said it was already doing what it agreed to in the EPA settlement. East Liverpool Mayor Ryan Stovall, though, was pleased.
And I'm glad to see the EPA did step in to help out and try to at least make some accountability to S.H. Bell.
But he says you can't drive out industries just because of pollution.
The thing is, when you get to small river towns like East Liverpool, every job is important. You know, we can't pick and choose a lot of times.
And many people in the town are hoping that East Liverpool is actually on the economic upswing and new jobs will be coming. But others fear more pollution. That's up next. For The Confluence, I'm Julie Grant.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Carol Holsapple of the Allegheny Front, along with my colleague, Julie Grant. East Liverpool, Ohio, just over the border from Pennsylvania, sits right between where two new industrial plants are in the works. Shell Chemical is building its $6 billion ethane cracker about 16 miles upriver in Pennsylvania. And now a second cracker is proposed for southeastern Ohio. In part one of our series looking at communities impacted by pollution, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant continues her look at the tension between jobs and a healthy environment for East Liverpool residents, where many hope the cracker plants will bring renewed life to this struggling industrial town.
Larry Heck is excited about all the new business he sees coming to Southern Columbiana County.
Oh, it's very, very well needed. It's been a depressed area for a long time, but that's about to change.
Heck runs Pier 48, which imports commodities on barges sent from the Gulf Coast up the Mississippi into the Ohio River, a few miles from East Liverpool. A huge overhead crane moves heavy cargo off river barges, commodities like soybeans from China. Today, it's picking up huge steel coils.
They weigh about 56 to 58,000 pounds each.
The slow-moving conveyor transfers them from the barge and carefully places them on the ground.
And they're going to a local steel mill up in Youngstown.
Heck says most of that steel will be used for natural gas pipelines. He says imports are on the rise, like the mineral barite used in natural gas drilling. The gas wells here will also feed the new ethane crackers in the region to produce plastic pellets. Penny Trina says that's going to be the game changer.
Once that plant gets up and running, we'll see a lot of offshoots of different plastics industries, I believe, all up and down the Ohio River.
Trina is CEO of the Columbiana County Port Authority, which has invested $14 million in Pier 48. She says location is everything.
So we're on the river. We're geographically blessed to be in between those two proposed cracker plants.
Trina expects that will bring even more spin-off industries as a result. She says it's the biggest growth industry since the steel mills.
I would say since the 70s, 78, 75, I don't think that we have seen an uptick of economic development like this.
86-year-old Richard Wolf has heard this story before. He's been a member of the East Liverpool School Board for decades and has been an activist against the hazardous waste incinerator.
We were told that this facility would be the catalyst for economic growth, and none of that ever happened.
Richard Wolf says of his 8 children, 6 had to leave to find jobs in their fields. But he says his sister left after that toxic ash release from the waste incinerator 5 years ago. It saturated her neighborhood.
We don't know how many people have fled because of fear of what might be in the way of a toxic atmosphere, a polluted environment.
Wolf laments that the community has not protected children from the effects of pollution like manganese, and he worries that the new ethane crackers and the plastics production will create more of the same.
If you go out there, we have blue cards for anybody who would like to testify.
This is another public hearing held by the Ohio EPA at a high school auditorium in Shadyside, a town in southeastern Ohio where an Asian company, PTTGCA, has proposed a $10 billion ethane cracker. It's promising 6,000 initial construction jobs and 500 permanent jobs. About 100 citizens showed up, many to officially comment on Ohio's draft air permit for the plant. The state estimates it would emit nearly 2 million tons of greenhouse gases a year, as well as hundreds of tons of volatile organic compounds, particulate matter, and other pollutants. Ohio EPA spokesperson Heidi Grismer says the cracker will not be allowed to push the region's air quality below federal standards.
The state, our mission is to protect all Ohioans, no matter where they live, and to ensure that there is good air quality for all Ohioans.
But for East Liverpool residents like Amanda Kiger, who've listened to regulators discuss the latest air violations at the hazardous waste incinerator, the parents waiting for the next round of results to find out how manganese is impacting their children's ability to learn, and those who've watched polluting industries come and go, it's hard for them to believe the community's health is getting much consideration compared with the excitement about jobs and economic growth from the gas industry.
Yeah, we're going to have money, we're going to have more sickness, and when all of that's done and that starts rotating out like those type of extractive industries do, we're just going to be left once again poor, sick. That's what our community is going to be left with.
So for better or worse, East Liverpool, like much of the Ohio Valley, is anxiously awaiting the coming chemical boom. For The Confluence, I'm Julie Grant of the Allegheny Front.
The Allegheny Front's coverage of environmental health is supported by the Pittsburgh Foundation and the Heinz Endowments. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, civil asset forfeitures, an old tool designed to take away ill-gotten gains from big-time criminals. but some police departments are using it to seize money and property from regular people and keep it to fund their own operations. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, with production assistance from Meg Fair and Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.